You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 27th of September 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live at RadioAryan.com, because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victors of World War II, none other than Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, hello there. How are you?
Hello. I'm pretty good this week, not too bad.
Excellent. Excellent. And I'm afraid we'll just have to let the listeners know that we still haven't got the mic problem sorted out, but hopefully we will next week. Hopefully we'll be able to get by like that. I can still understand you, Dennis, anyway. I'm sure our listeners will be able to put up with that. How is everything else going? Have you been working on the documentary series?
Yeah, I've been working on the closing credits, but what I've also done is included important bits of information which I found during the research of the secret Masonic victory, which really, you know, needs to be shown. So, and it's an ideal opportunity.
Can you give us a clue as to what any of that is?
Yeah, well, there's like, for instance, we talked about the document which was sent to me about the Austrian document, which stipulated that the lies must stop about the gassings, saying that, especially the Jews, saying that there were gassings in these camps. The list of all the camps are there. And it's an official document from Austria in 1948.
Fantastic, fantastic. And I mean, it was really only the Russian camps where they made these allegations, and the Russian camps, nobody could go in to check. I mean, this is after the war. Obviously, there were rumours beforehand that the Jews were putting out and about deliberately, but when it was checked, it was found that there was nothing in the camps that the Allies were in, and it was just these allegations that the Russians were making. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, and what coincides with all this is evidence I have of Russian rapes at Auschwitz and Auschwitz prisoners.
What, when they liberated the camp?
Yes.
Wow. Well, that's been hushed up for quite some time.
Does that surprise you, really, when you think about it?
Not really, when you think about the Red Army and what they got up to elsewhere.
But, yeah, it's mass rape everywhere they went.
Yeah, but you would have thought that, you know, they made this big thing about liberating these camps and liberating these prisoners of war, to be going in there and raping them. I'm surprised that they've been able to keep that quiet. Where did you find that information from then?
Well, I've got some text about it, and I've got from a documentary of a Jewish woman telling a story.
I bet there's a lot of stuff that's in Russian that, you know, just hasn't actually been translated into English. You think about Solzhenitsyn's book, 200 Years Together, about Russia and the Jews, and that was suppressed from being translated into English. I think there's amateur translations or unofficial translations into English, and you think he was a big award winner, and he was lionized by the West when he wrote his books, and yet they managed to keep that quiet. You just wonder what else there is, what documentaries there are that just haven't been translated into English that tell a different story, because they do seem to they seem to be quite awake to the problem over there. And even with the law, the Holocaust law that we have over here, they tried to get one put in Russia, which I think we probably talked about in the past. And then when they tried to use it, these Jews tried to use it against this historian, and he was saying, well, look, I'm looking at these records and the numbers don't add up, basically. And the Jews took him to court over this. And the result of the court case was that the law got struck down. And they said, you know, this law is not meant to apply to legitimate historians that are researching the past. You can't make a law to prevent people researching the past. This is just there to stop people putting out propaganda that could undermine the Russian state. basically. And the law got thrown out. And there was a huge...
Well, that makes common sense, that, doesn't it?
Yeah, there was a huge uproar about it. And there were all these youngsters making videos where they were saying, I believe in the Holocaust. I believe in the Holocaust. It doesn't make sense to believe in Christianity anymore or believe in gravity, but we do believe in the Holocaust. You know, just all making jokes about it like that. And there was... It was like a whole video of it, and there was graffiti up everywhere. And from what I learned about it, the whole area was furious about this, that these Jews had the cheek to try and prosecute this historian. And I think that the money or the funding for a synagogue got withdrawn, like a massive uproar over this that we really didn't hear about over here in Britain. So they certainly seem to be, you know, more open to questioning it than we do over here anyway, say the least.
And what we believe to as well. Yeah. I mean, I was looking at the figures for the immigration figures in Britain and in Europe, and you know, it looks like it isn't going to be long before we are in a minority, especially when you go through the ages, like I said, the teenagers, and then, you know, the group from teenagers to 27, these will disappear first, you know, and the older end, you know, was the last to go, and it's not that far away. And when we were looking at it, there was this, what they were saying in this piece I was reading, was that Eastern Europeans at the moment are the last kind of stumbling block, you know, with Poland, Hungary, and Latvia. And I think there's like four or five of them. I think war's just been finished now in Macedonia, which will stop them coming in, just like the Hungarian one did. So there's a bit of resistance there, at least, you know, there is a section of Europe still, you know, trying to stay white, if you like.
And they're putting in programs to help that as well. I was really pleased to see just a couple of weeks back, Viktor Orban held a big conference, and they had people from Poland there, people from Italy there, and they were saying we have to do something about the European birth rates. And I think Viktor Orban has said something like, I think it's something like £30,000 or €30,000 loan that each family will get, and if you have three children, that will pay the loan off. And there's €100 that the Polish families get when they have children. Russia has introduced all these incentives to encourage more Russian children. Slovakia has as well. And the whole point of it is we cannot do like...
Well,
they're saying we cannot do like Western Europe. We cannot be importing Africans to replace our own people, because we'll just die out. We have to increase our own people. So at least they are doing that in the East. But over
that's unbelievable. I haven't heard that either. I mean, like I say, a lot of this is suppressed, got to be.
Yeah. Well, they make it out to be a bad thing, and they make Orban out to be racist for doing this. But, you know, you can't... Anybody reading that is going to say, well, that's not racist. That's just sensible. And why aren't we doing that in Britain? Because as you say, Dennis, I mean, if you look at the figures for the generations, I think it's in 40 years' time that we'll be a minority here in Britain.
It's not far away.
And if you look at the youngest generation, if you look at like 5-year-olds, I mean, already the non-whites are in the majority. The majority of new births are non-white.
Yeah,
or foreign.
Schools in London are particularly... Now there's a minority of kids, white kids there in schools in London. So,
and you think, you know, the problems used to be 70 or 80 years ago, you used to have problems with the French moving into Germany, or the Poles taking a little bit of German land, and concern about that. And, you know, that pales into insignificance.
Pales into exactly. Yeah. This is a whole different ballgame. This is Kalergi's plan.
Yeah. And I saw a newspaper article, actually, that mentioned Kalergi as well. And this was to do with forming the EU in, I think, 1926. And it mentioned this big Jewish group that were driving to have a United States of Europe. And it's good because it showed a link between Kudinov Kalergi, Jewish advocacy groups, and the formation of the EU. Someone dropped
Jewish
it in the chat room. Yeah, well, surely. I mean, these people were all lined up together in it. And this is what the National Socialists could see were coming, and this is what they were fighting against. And again, tonight we're going to be looking at Joseph Goebbels' pamphlet that he wrote, The Nazi Sozi, which was just describing National Socialism to a beginner, basically, like an older National Socialist talking to a young Nationalist and explaining what the ideals of National Socialism were. We did part one last week, and we got part two to go through this week. The first bit that we've got there is our demands, and this is what the demands of the National Socialists are. And what does the German worker have to do in return? Nothing in the world is free, and so the worker should bear in mind, if he wants to be free, he must make sacrifices to this end. No one can make him free. He has to do it himself. And since freedom is the ultimate, he must stake his utmost, life itself. And I'll just stop there because it just, you know, it just strikes me that there's two things there. They're saying you have to make sacrifices to be free. Nobody can do it for you. And that's the opposite of what we're told today. We're told the government can give you rights. The government will make you free. The government will guarantee your right to sodomy. The government will guarantee your right to not be criticized. The government tries to do these things. And what they're saying is, no, you, if you want to be free, you have to make sacrifices to that end. And then the second bit that strikes me about that, it says, since freedom is the ultimate, he must stake his utmost, life itself. And I think there's Christian overtones to that, where it says that no greater love does a man have than if he lays down his life for his friends. Lay down your life for your nation. So just two things there that strike me about it. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, you can't trust your government. Prime example, I mean, look at all the pensions. People's lost all the money, you know, all these pensions they've been saving up for years. You know, you just can't trust the government. You've got to be done yourself.
Well, this is what they were pointing out back then. You know, this is why we say we lost the war, because they put a stop to all these problems. And then since we lost the war, everything that was happening in Weimar Germany has happened throughout the rest of the Western world, and worse.
And New Zealand, Australia, America.
These ideas that the National Socialists had, I mean, they might have called them National Socialism, but they were basically just based on natural laws, and anybody needs to adhere to them if they want to free their nation. The second part, he says, a goal always stands in direct proportion to the energy expended in attaining it. Only liars promise heaven in return for a party membership card. But we say liberty is everything, and for that reason, it demands everything from us, a long, bitter struggle filled with hardship and worry and arduousness and hunger and danger and a constant sacrificing of health, pleasure, happiness and contentment. That's what the German worker must provide. But at the end of it all, the best possible reward beckons, a free Germany of productive labour. So again, he's saying we're not promising you wonderful things, far from it. We're actually promising you a very, very hard time, because you're going to have to fight and struggle to get what you want. And in actual fact, by doing that fighting and struggling, it gives value to the prize at the end of it.
Yeah, it's amazing how they made Germany out not to be free, you know, all the propaganda.
Well, also, you know, you only get out of life what you put into it. You can't expect to be given things for free. It's only when you take on responsibility and you work and you strive hard to achieve something that you have a sense of achievement in achieving it. You know, if you're rich and you've got all the money in the world, you know, it doesn't mean anything when you purchase something. You know, easy come, easy go. If you've worked
the elite,
hard for it.
I mean, the sons of the elite are given that privilege. They don't really, I think their lives are mapped out before they're even up and running.
And they don't appreciate what they've actually got. And also, I think you know, the means, the end never justifies the means.
You know, I think they have a different ends and different means. I mean, Cameron, to me, has a totally different means and ends that I would have liked to see from Germany. You know, he has no regard for the people of this country. One of the tribe, obviously.
Oh yeah, but he, I mean, his way of looking at it, he would be saying, "Well, I'm trying to achieve something good at the end of it, so it doesn't matter if we do lots of bad things along the way to get there." And you know, that's saying the end justifies the means, and that's what communism was saying. We have to break a few eggs to make an omelet. We have to kill a few million, maybe 100 million people, but at the end of it, we'll have a workers' paradise. You can't do that. The means have to be an end in themselves, which is what the National Socialists were saying, because through struggling to achieve something good and doing it the right way and doing it the moral way, they would also be improving themselves, improving their character and becoming better people through doing it, and have a better sense of achievement. So the way that they actually go about trying to achieve power is as important as what they do when they actually have the power, because otherwise they wouldn't have been worthy of it.
I'm just saying that in this country, people don't really have to work that hard for power in certain sections of this, of the elite.
Well, it's all based upon money here, isn't it? It's all based on who's got the most money and
connections, yeah.
And that wouldn't be so bad if people could only earn money in an honest way through innovation and being careful with it, but it's earned through usury. It's earned through having money in the first place.
And it's making us pay for mistakes like the bankers and all, everything else. We're the ones who have to fork out all the time. Where they don't suffer at all. I mean, I don't think there's one banker ever been jailed in this country.
Well, they bailed them out. They didn't bail out Thomas Cook, did they? You think of all those poor people that are stranded abroad, and exactly. You know, they're going to have to pay for all that themselves, because the government didn't want to bail out the travel agents. They won't bail anybody out.
$200 million to government, nothing.
Yeah,
and they're not interested.
Going to be hit those people a lot harder than it would have hit the government. But the government are quite happy to just bail out these banks. It's because they don't have. They don't have a sense of national loyalty. They've got no ethnic loyalty to the people that they're ruling.
They certainly haven't. It's just self.
And this goes back to what we were talking about last week, about how if people were taught that the people around them were their extended family, and they actually were, they were part of the same nation and the same race, then there would be a lot more loyalty, and there'd be a lot less chance of employers ripping the people that were under them off, which is National Socialism. It's everybody working together for the benefit of the nation. That's what he's saying here. You know, we all need to be working together for the good of the nation, and I can't promise you that you're going to get rich from this. All I can promise you is a harsh struggle. And again, there's Christian parallels to that, because that's pretty much what Christ tells his disciples, isn't it?
You don't mind that, as long as you know that your government, I don't think it's that difficult to tell either, but if you can see that your government is actually working for you and the people of the country, then fair enough. But it's pretty obvious in this country that they don't work at all for, the common man.
Yeah, why would anybody want to be making sacrifices for the government that we have now?
Exactly.
Clamping down on freedoms,
privileges.
Taking away the money from the poor and the elderly and the disabled, and giving it to foreigners that come in,
They put the pensions to a point now where I think a woman used to be 60, now she's 65, the guy's now 70, it used to be 65. It's just so petty. It really annoys me, it really does.
Well, with automation, I mean, that age should be coming down. People should be able to retire earlier.
Exactly.
Because of these great advances. Because of these great advances we've made. Again, this was a part of National Socialism. It was saying that the things that that we Germans create out of our innovation, all of Germany should be benefiting from that. So, the more innovation there was, the more advanced the nation became, the better the standard of living became for everyone, and a portion of the profits were put towards improving the lives of everybody that was there. It's like when I was saying, when you create the the power lines, say, electricity, and when we created the railways and when we created the roadways, all and the telephone lines, communication, all of that should be free. Once that was created,
yeah.
it shouldn't be there to make a profit, because we created it. Our ancestors created it. Our ancestors built the network. If it costs something to keep it running, that should obviously be paid for. But there shouldn't be a profit in it for private companies, because that's the wealth of the nation. That's the wealth of our intellectual endeavors to create these things. And that was the way of thinking that was behind National Socialism. Now, as I say, I think we dealt with some of that last week, didn't we?
Can I just say, though, in the case of a notice the other day on TV, I just happened to notice where they were advertising for people to send money to cancer, but instead of saying sending money for cancer, can you leave it in your will? Now, there is some people suspect that there's already been a cure for cancer. And in fact, it were the Germans that actually discovered the cancer when it was robbed after World War II. So I looked into some research about it all, and I think it was last year or the year before, I think 178,000 people died of cancer in Germany. In Israel, 22.
So they've obviously got better cancer treatment over there in Israel. Somehow.
Someone's telling you something.
I wonder if it's to do with stem cells and harvested body parts. That wouldn't surprise me.
You know, no, not at all.
His body parts from abortions and from circumcisions and all these stem cells and bits and pieces that they take, where do they go and what are they used for? You know, I'm only speculating there, but to have a...
Yeah, it's suspicious, so yeah.
Have a cancer rate that is that low, you know, it's suspicious, isn't it? Well, the next section is on the difference between international and national. In other words, you want to counter the international Marxism with the nationalism of German socialism? Exactly. Finally, we've begun to understand each other. But you do have to grant me one more question. If you recognise that the enemy, whether we call him the Jews, capitalism, or whatever, thinks and feels internationally, then surely he can't be combated in any but an international way. And the result of such a fight will be the International of Socialism, which shatters once and for all the International of Capitalism. So a bit of a question there about, well, hang on a minute, don't you need to be international to be international socialism, international communism? He says, I can see, my friend, I can talk until I'm blue in the face, and it's all the same in the end. We just can't come clear with each other. Try to think logically. Number one, of course, we have recognised clearly that the enemy is taking up international residence on the backs of the European nations. There are barely any national kinds of capital left in Germany. The railways, mines, factories, money, gold, the National Bank, everything has been converted into stock papers, which repose in the safes of Jewish banks in London and New York. But papers in and of themselves are worthless. They don't roll on railway tracks, they don't yield any coal, don't produce any bread or goods, and don't create or maintain value. They only serve to skim off the interest. If we had a real German state, it would declare all German stock stashed in Jewish banks null and void. It would treat them as the scraps of paper that they are, and would proclaim a government of national labour in Germany. Since we don't have such a state, we must instead put up with the blessings of the Dawes colony. There's no national wealth and no national capital. That is, wealth and capital belonging to the people, to the nation. Instead, everything is under the management of an international syndicate of banks. National capital does not work for us on the international scene. Rather, hyenas of international finance work with it internationally. You know, there's loads there, but I think when you said about the blessings of the Dawes colony, that would be the Dawes plan, don't you think?
It would probably be, yeah. I'm thinking that myself.
Yeah, that's what he's referring to there. And again, he's pointing out that everything is owned by foreigners because of this stock market system that we've got, stock papers, mines, factories, money, gold. None of it's actually owned by the Germans themselves. because of usury and because of the banking system, it's siphoned off all this money in interest, so that parts of everything is owned. It's all mortgaged, and we're in the same way here in Britain.
Exactly the same. I'm just going to say, all the football clubs, is there any in English hands now?
Well, yeah, not. I mean, as far as football clubs, I mean, that's sad, isn't it? You know, things that are even supposed to be owned by that little area that the football club is from, they should be owning it, and it's owned by foreigners. And when you think about it, when he's saying here that these papers in and of themselves are worthless, they don't roll on railway tracks, don't yield any coal. I mean, that's very true. You need people to do these things. You can have as much money or as much paper in the world, but what you really need is people to put value into that paper by doing work. So if what you need when you have these bits of paper that you're using as currency, it needs to reflect actual labor. It needs to be worth something. And the paper we have isn't worth anything at all, because it's based on debt.
The mortgage in it. I mean, you might go along and negotiate a mortgage. It's not really negotiated because it needs two to sign a contract, really. But only you sign the contract, and you never actually see the money that you actually lent. It's just fitting in the air. And when you paid your mortgage off, you paid all that money back. Really, for what?
Yeah, it's created when you sign up that bit of paper. That's when that money is created. And then when you pay it back, it doesn't get zeroed. You pay it back with interest, and it goes to the bank. So you've effectively created it twice. You've created it by putting your signature there, and then you've got to work like crazy to gather that money again from the system so that you can pay it back. So you've actually created it twice, and you've got one thing of value then. You've got a house which goes into the basic value of everything that the nation owns. You can look at that as something that the nation owns. But so what's interest got to do with that? Why are the banks creaming off this?
You don't need interest for that, do you?
And again, when you look at this and you say, well, what about gold then? Well, doesn't matter how much gold you've got, you still need people to be doing this work. It's the people themselves that have the most value.
A man can't dig itself.
No, and the quality of the people is also very, very important. I mean, what's the point in having a million low IQ Negroes with an IQ of under 70? They're never going to innovate anything. You know, one German with an IQ of 130 is going to be worth a million of those Negroes with an IQ of 70, because he's going to invent things that are going to be labour saving.
So they've got all these Africans over in like they have now in London and most of the South, then they're never going to work out a farm system in a month of Sundays. So they're right for more pickings.
They were right. The National Socialists were definitely right to place so much value in their people, because that is the real source of value. That's where everything comes from, is from our creation. If it wasn't for us here, there would be nothing. There would be no products. There'd be no innovation. We're the most valuable things that our nation has, and it should be investing everything, all the profit that we make should be invested in us.
Yeah.
Should be invested in us to bring us to the best that we can possibly be. Our potential. Basically, we have the potential to be so much better than we actually are, because we're not given the right tools to make the most of our potential. Because a lot of the time, because we're dragged down, because you've got low IQ people here, and you have to, you put them in the same classroom, and all the attention gets put on them to try and bring them up. And the people with the potential to be much, much better than they actually are, they just get left alone, because it's more important to the teacher and the school to drag up the lower ones than to concentrate on the ones that have the highest skills. And when that gets translated across the whole nation, it means that instead of getting fantastic innovations and leading the world, you've just got a pretty average nation. This is why Germany led the world and was 10 years in advance of everyone else. because they invested in their people and gave them the tools that they needed to reach their full potential in every possible way. It's all about thinking what's most important, and it's the nation that is the most important, not the individual. It's the nation needs to be put first.
Well, it's a different mindset from Kalergi, where Kalergi thinks, you know, build a Europe full of people with low intelligence, just enough to get to work and back, and that then will make them even more superior.
When they're just looking at people as economic units, aren't they? They're just thinking, right,
yes.
Each person can earn me an average of X. So if we have all these people together, they'll each be worth an average of this. Whereas the proper way to look at it, the way that's in tune with natural law, is, well, this group of people are worth more than that group of people. And if you invest in this group of people, and every one of a thousand is going to be an absolute genius. And what you do is invest 10 times as much in that one that's an absolute genius. And get the very best out of him, because that genius could create 1,000 new inventions.
Absolutely true.
And you got your low IQ Negro. None of them are ever going to come up with an invention. They didn't even come up with a sailing boat.
They're not expected to, though. This is the thing. They don't want to. They're quite happy to rule over this subjugated, low-rated species, which Kalergi wanted and needs now again.
Yeah, well, that was the plan, wasn't it? To turn us into the equivalent of Arabs and have us ruled over by elite Jews. Jews
and look around us.
But even the Jews, though, I mean, they rely on Gentiles a lot for the inventions, and then they develop them.
Well, yeah, I'm not disputing that, but maybe they're happy with what they've got. I don't know, because they're not going to get any more computers invented and things like that with the way they're going with the population that they've intended for.
Yeah, we do look like we've had peak civilization and peak inventions from some of the things that I've read, and there's been a definite drop down in the number of geniuses that are born, and obviously the average IQ of the nation drops every year because of immigration, and also because of the standards of education are getting lower and lower and lower.
Everything is, even music. It's worse than I've ever heard. I turned on a BBC programme the other night and it was Britain rapping. Well, that's nothing to do with the culture of Britain, in my eyes. But obviously there's that many of them around today now in the country that it's part of British culture now to be rapping.
We no longer have a culture that encourages excellence and superiority. We have a culture that... mocks excellence and superiority and says that it's got unearned privilege and it shouldn't be where it is, and it's not fair that the superior genius there is white, and what we should really be doing is putting in a disabled black person there regardless of how intelligent they are. I mean, that's what we do with all these diversity quotas. We don't reward excellence anymore. We don't reward it. And the second bit is...
But don't think black people in wheelchairs are immune from the wrath at some stage.
Yeah, well, you know, I dare say, and also the homosexuals. And they use them as well, don't they, as their avant-garde, as their proxy warriors. They're quite happy to get rid of them.
They'll use them, yeah.
Well, like you said with communism, I mean, once the communists got in, you know, they got rid of the Freemasons. They were happy to use the Freemasons to get in, but once they got in, they had no more use for them. Got rid of them.
Yeah, and which I'm sure some Freemasons are going to find out shortly as it is.
Yeah. Number two, the fight against this world power does, of course, have to be fought internationally, and it would be very short-sighted indeed of us if we were not to support in all countries each and every movement which fights on the same front line as we do. But the goal of this fight is never, by no means, a world republic of socialism. There has never been any such thing, and there never will be. It exists only in the minds of Jewish traitors to the working class and of misled German workers. The true goal is the establishment of new nationalistic socialist states. We also place little or no stock in a united international struggle of nations against the international of finance. There are far too many barriers to such international communication and cooperation. The International of Capital would also not be so foolish as to enslave all peoples and nations in the same way at the same time. It all happens step by step and one by one, and no nation thinks to equate its situation with that of a previous case, as each believes that it can still save itself by means of compliance and relenting until it is too late for that nation too, and it has been swallowed up in its turn by the Moloch of capitalism. And I think that, you know, that shows that National Socialism wasn't about conquering the world. It wasn't about building an empire. It was about a nationalist state wanting to form alliances with other nationalist states. And not conquering the, I mean, it's saying there, you know, you've got too many barriers to having an international thing. You've got a different culture, you've got different religion, you've got different language, but it doesn't mean that you know, you can't help each other out. And I think we've got that now with white nationalism, haven't we? You know, I celebrate when good things happen to nationalists in America, in Italy, in Austria, in Hungary. You know, and we get a lot of different white folks from different nations in our chat room, and we all can see the same problems in our countries, and we're all struggling against the same problems that we can see, and we try to help one another out. But it doesn't mean we're disloyal to our own country, or
I think there has been a big awakening, maybe not big enough yet, but I certainly think there has been a sizable awakening, you know, to at least worry these people, you know what I mean? Because I think they were expecting to just coast along till it comes a point where they didn't have to reveal anything, and then everyone would have just been took by surprise. But I think with so many being awakened over the past couple of years, which always showed up on the YouTube comments for the last couple of years, which is why I believe YouTube just wiped everybody up, because they were beginning to lose that battle. And so, you know, they are worried about the fact that more than what they expected to know by now do actually know what's going on. Not enough in my eyes, but, you know, there's more every day.
Oh, yeah, we can see that, you know, we've got them backed into a corner. Otherwise, you know, they wouldn't be exposing themselves so much with, you know, the way that they use these laws to try and silence people, especially on the internet, you know, people that claim to support freedom of speech and freedom of conscience that are then locking people up for questioning what went on 70 years ago and asking questions about the science of it. I also think this here, I mean, it shows that the National Socialists would have wanted nothing to do with the European Union.
Because,
you know, that's an accusation that gets made. That, you know, that the EU is made up of Nazis, and yet when you look at this, that it was totally what they were against.
Well, they were hunting Kalergi. They almost got him twice. He almost got him in France and in Czechoslovakia, but he managed to escape to America. But if they got him, they'd have shot him. No doubt about it.
So they were after him then. They were well aware of what he was doing.
Yeah, I did a section in that in the last episode, Communism by the Back Door, where he had some nice savoury words for him, did Hitler.
I wouldn't mind. I have to go and check that out, Dennis, because I often get people, you know, trying to say that Kudinov Kalergi was aligned with Hitler. So I'd like to get that.
Aligned with Truman, maybe. Yeah. You know, no Hitler.
Maybe we could do more on Kalergi another time. Maybe we could revisit that. Mm. Continuing here, he says, "And further, my friend, we don't have time to wait for all the others. We are on the brink of our last final collapse. And in this situation, it is nothing short of a crime to count on the help of others who have never helped us yet and probably won't help us in the future. What counts for us is the maxim, God helps those who help themselves." Again, that's another Christian quote there.
Yeah, exactly.
No good just asking for help. You have to help yourself. And that, again, that was what National Socialism was about. It wasn't about giving everybody welfare. It was about giving everybody a job and a chance to go out and work and earn a good living for themselves. Not saying, well, if you can't find work, we'll give you these benefits. We'll find you work. Here is this work. Help yourself and raise yourself up out of the dirt and improve your life and have some self-satisfaction at contributing to the community through doing it. You know, I was listening to...
And that's actually from the youth upwards, isn't it? They used to be proud to do things,
I was listening to Radio Free Northwest the other day, and they had a bit of Jordan Peterson on there, and he was talking about... Yeah, it was quite good, actually. He was talking about rights and responsibilities. And he was saying, you know, rights don't inspire anyone. Rights don't make anyone into a man. What makes someone into a man is responsibility. Being responsible for something and doing your absolute very best at that. And that brings, that's what brings you contentment. You know, that's what makes you into a man is being responsible. Not all these, all this stuff about rights. That doesn't inspire people. And it's the same as what they're saying here. God helps those who help themselves. Being responsible for yourself and taking charge of your life, you know, that's what brings you satisfaction, and that's what the meaning of life is responsibility. Saying I can be responsible for this and being responsible for it, like when you're responsible for your family or whatever. You know, you just be responsible for small things or responsible for larger things. But when you do that, then you know that you have value yourself. You are of value to other people. And it's when we are of value to other people that we have, we value ourselves then, because we know that we're of value and we're happy with who we are. And that's what it takes.
The difficulty is that, you know, and he's right what he's saying about, you know, that makes a man. But where are all the real men now? A lot of them have all been either wiped out in wars or various other means. You know, today you've got a man today who's hardly what you would call a man back in them days.
And they're not taught how to be men today. They're told, oh no,
they're not taught, no.
Yeah, you should be getting in touch with your female side. Or, you know, but it's okay for boys to cry. Why don't you play with these dollies over here and try not to be gender specific? You know,
all this comes into play.
And all of it is to emasculate men so that men are no longer men and don't realize who they really are and what we are really capable of. Now, that's what's at the root of it.
Well, I look at some men on TV sometimes, whether it be newsreaders or weathermen or whoever, and I sometimes look at them and I think, would they go over a wall like, you know, the Germans did? And I just can't imagine it. You know, physically possible.
And were the Germans going over the wall for human rights or civil rights, or were they going over there because they felt responsible for their nation?
Correct.
Yeah, they knew their nation was counting on them. That's why they fought to defend it.
Not for as long as they could.
Number three, if you keep talking about an international of socialism, you only prove that you fail to understand even the most basic natural foundations of nation and people. No great conception of a state, and socialism is certainly one, has ever led to an international. The guiding principle of history is not blending, but diversity and difference. That has always been so, always will be so. Fighting is what shapes peoples and nations, and anyone who refuses to fight is doomed. You may say that is terrible, but that is the way it is. We have to come to terms with it and to fight. History is shaped by eternal laws of nature, not by placatory Marxist phrases. Of course, where he says diversity there, he means proper diversity, where you've got black people living over there, yellow people living over there, white people living over there, red people living over there, not all blended together. I mean, what we're told is diversity today, it isn't diversity. It's trying to blend all the people together. It's division. It's division rather than diversity, because you're splitting the nation up by trying to make it multicultural. So he's right there. That's what guides history. You know, where have there ever been a great conception of a state that has worked for more than just one nation? There isn't anywhere.
No, I think this is why we're finding these countries in Eastern Europe now with people in it who may have agreed with a lot of what the EU was doing, obviously to be in a position where they were. But there's something inside them telling them, that, you know, you don't really want to lose your white heritage. And it must be some kind of gene inside because they're certainly standing solid.
Well, it's unnatural, isn't it? And he says that in the next quote.
Yes.
Here. Nature loves diversity, not uniformity. It does not want a homogeneous porridge of mankind. It wants mankind composed of many different peoples and races, among which the strongest will ever hold its own against the weak. We have recognized this fact and are willing to act accordingly in order to help our German nation forge the weapons it needs in the struggle for existence on this earth so that it can assert itself in this world of struggle and of triumph of the stronger over the weaker. That's what we call being nationalistic. And I think, you know, a point needs to be made here about the stronger winning over the weaker. Again, if you've got white people that have got that innovation, you've got 100 white people, you know, they could conquer 100,000 Negroes if we hadn't given them our technology. And what would be better? Having the world run by Negroes or the world or just a country even run by Negroes or having it run by white people? It's obviously better being run by white people because we have a concept of justice and civilization, and they recognize that fact. So, I mean, nature is set out to put things right, to have the strongest people that should win will be the best people. They'll be the best people to be in that position of ruling, basically. What's messed it up is...
Which is why, of course...
Go on.
I can hark back to just after World War One, when Germany only had 100,000 army, when all the time the Bolsheviks were around the corner. So what did that leave Germany expose us?
Well, it left Germany massively, massively exposed.
Yeah, on purpose. Yeah.
I say the reason why that is now messed up is because we've allowed these foreigners to come into our nations and put them in these positions above us, and we've allowed Jews to come into the nation. So instead of being ethnically homogenous within one nation, we've allowed other people to come in, and we've allowed them to get into positions of importance, and they brought more and more in until the nation has become corrupted.
Yeah, I think the next election is between a Muslim London mayor and a challenger who is Caribbean.
That really wouldn't surprise me. And also, as I say, when you think about usury and you're thinking about the stronger and the weaker, the most intelligent person with the most wealth that has amassed, you know, he's a lord, and he's got people that are working under him, and he's an intelligent guy. He's got lots of wealth. He's going to rise up to the top, and he's going to be a good man. You're going to want a good man at the top, and it's the good man that's going to be the strongest. And that's why we had good kings in the past, and that's why they were in the position that they were, because they were in the right position. When it's talking about the stronger and the weaker, it's not talking about smashing the weaker. The stronger should make their way to the top. And a good strong man will defend the weaker from other bad strong men, which is why they liked us in India, because we protected them from fighting amongst one another. Do you know what I mean there, Dennis? I mean, that's the honourable thing. The honourable strong man will protect the weaker from being attacked, you know?
I can see that angle.
If it's unjust. This might makes right. I think that gets misunderstood, because if the person really is the mightiest, you know, good triumphs over evil. So they're going to be the most right as well, because good triumphs over evil, light triumphs over dark. So the one who is truly is the mightiest. Yeah, he is going to be the most right, and the one who is truly the most righteous is, you know, the one that has the virtue there. I mean, I would say that, you know, even though it may look like Hitler and the National Socialists lost the war, I mean, Hitler maintained his integrity till the very end. He never lost the battle with himself. He never lost the battle with himself to behave immorally or dishonorably. He behaved honorably throughout. So in the grand scheme of things, you know, he didn't fail. Whereas people like Churchill and people like Stalin that behaved immorally and dishonorably, you know, they lost. They were failures personally as people. They were complete failures. Whereas Hitler was an incredible success as a person with his character.
Well, the argument I always have with people who say that Hitler were a Christian was if he was a Christian and a good person, he would have won World War II. The answer to that is obviously, what's your excuse for World War One?
Also, we live in a fallen world and a corrupted world, and you can't escape from the consequences of things that have gone on in the past. You just have, this is why, you know, we have to accept what we have today, because things happened 70 years ago that are still affecting us today, and you can't change those things. It's like if you're locked in a cell, you know, you can't get out of the cell. You just have to make do with your life within that cell, and you have to make the best of it, because that's the consequence of being locked in that cell. And the consequence of what happened 70 years ago is what we have today. But the reason why, you know, the war failed and the rest of it is, I guess, because we had already become too corrupted. The rest of us had. I mean, because Hitler was looking to Britain and thinking Britain was going to support him, but Britain had also become so corrupted with the Jews.
Well, I mean, you look at the size of Germany as well, and I never actually envisaged Germany as small as they were, because they were probably smaller than Texas, and yet had such a mighty army, which was willing to go all the way, fought for 6 years against the whole world. You know, I mean, you can be as righteous as you want, but when you've got them odds and you can't sustain your losses, then it's always going to be a problem.
Well, again, this is why I say, you know, it's more important to look at your own personal character and what you can do within your own life, rather than looking to things you can't actually change and thinking, well, you know, if we can take power, we'll take over the government and we'll be able to do this. Well, you know, Hitler did that, but he still failed, because we have this corrupted world. But the reason why they got as far as they did was because the German people had worked on their character, and they were trying to be as virtuous as they could be and realize their full potential as Aryans, because they had been taught that. They'd been taught the truth about their history, the truth about who they were. So each individual that was fighting in the German army was, you know, a cut above the people that they were fighting against, because they were tapping into their ancestors.
I think people are seeing that more today as well, because after the propaganda of, you know, they thought that they were the ruling race and all this kind of carry on, the Aryans and whatever. I think it's coming through now just exactly what kind of people they really were, the Germans. And you've got to admire them. You really have.
Well, the worst of it is the way they've attacked the SS, isn't it? I mean, they were really chivalrous.
Yeah.
You know, they were being trained to be perfect examples to the rest of the German nation. They were supposed to be highly moral, highly educated, physically at their prime, you know, as well as super intelligent, super educated, and have the very best manners. They were supposed to be a new elite.
Yeah.
And we just don't, you know.
They were, yeah. But I mean, like, I can now say to people, go to Google there, put Hitler and the occult, and then when it gets to Google, just press images, and you'll just see a whole lot of crap about the SS and what they were doing and torturing and raping women and all these Jewish comics and all this kind of, a whole pages of it, even now. You know, just to get people thinking that the SS were that evil.
And they had lots of rules that they had to keep to. They had very strict laws, and even when you look at the German army, they had very strict rules about the way that prisoners were to be treated, and they weren't to steal anything from the people that they captured. The people that were running the prison camps, and they had court martials of them for treating the prisoners badly, and investigations.
They also had paedophiles executed, according to Hitler, in the early days, when he found out some of the National Socialist leadership were involved in child molesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Executed.
I mean, that's what they said, wasn't it? You know, we executed National Socialists for that, and we're not going to let churchmen off because they're churchmen. If we catch them doing something like that, they will be executed.
Yeah.
And that's because they wanted to keep to the moral high ground. Because they knew that if they kept to the moral high ground, even if they did lose the war, there would still be people that cherished their memory and held their memory alive like there is today, like we're still talking about them today, because they kept to the moral high ground.
Well, yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of it has been hidden for 70 years, but thankfully, you know, people are beginning to realise.
Yeah, it wasn't just like a battle between, I don't know, Britain and Napoleon Bonaparte, which, you know, which doesn't get talked about because, you know, they were both just fighting a battle. But what the National Socialists were doing was fighting for the virtue of Europe, fighting for a higher ideal.
And some English elite looked at Germany as that role, saved Christianity from this attack of Bolsheviks.
A spiritual battle.
Indeed.
And they in order to do that, they were drawing on the power of their ancestors, where they had looked into their history and saw themselves as being a link in a chain going all the way back and being connected to them and honouring them and wanting to honour their ancestors. They weren't fighting for wages. I mean, what are people in the British Army today fighting for? What are they fighting for?
Yeah.
You know, they're told
what's the opportunity? It's a footballer or you join the army. Otherwise, you work at Tesco's.
You know, in the army, if you say you're a patriot, that's a reason for suspicion, because you might be a far right extremist. Yeah, they got a list of things that people are to watch out for. One of them is calling London is Stan, and another one is calling yourself a patriot. I mean, what else should somebody want to join the army for if not for being, because they're a patriot, because they love their country and they want to defend it. That was the whole point of the army. But now they just want people to join up so that they can pay them. Where's the honour in that? Where's the nobility in that? You know, where are the tales going to be told of valour and derring do of somebody that was just fighting for money? You know, they might as well just be in a boxing match or something.
And a lot of kids who messed up, who did join and go out to Iraq and place a lot of them.
Yeah, because they realise that they've been conned and they're not actually fighting for what they thought they were. They're fighting to advance Zionist interests and capitalist interests, and they're not actually there to defend their country or to defend their nation.
Once they're finished with, you know, I mean, they might be on decent money, or I mean, they collect a lot of money before they come back home, so they got plenty of money to work with the mates. But once they've left the army, as you know, they're not looked after.
No. And what were the National Socialists doing, or Germany doing, going into Russia? Were they going into Russia against the communists to liberate those countries from communism and to protect Western Europe from communism? They weren't going in there for Germany's interests. They were going in there, or partially for Germany's interests, but also for the interests of their European brothers. So they're laying down their lives for their brothers.
Exactly.
You know, that no greater love does a man have than he lay down his life for his friends or his racial kin. And what happened there, you had, you know, the Waffen-SS and all these other European soldiers that joined up to go and fight against communism to save all the countries of Europe. Incredibly noble.
So they never remembered.
Oh, we remember them.
Any remembrance celebrations going on or commemorations. They just went to a gulag and other, you know, what was it? I think it was 6 million, 3 million Germans. And only, 25,000 came back? That's what I call a Holocaust.
Well, this is why we say, you know, the truth always rises to the surface. The truth will always come out in the end, because we are talking about it now, because we know what a noble deed it was that they were performing. And that's why we discuss it now. And, you know, that's why their actions are immortal, but the actions of, you know, just any other battle or war, it might be talked about historically, but it won't be talked about in spiritual terms.
No, it wasn't. It's like I keep saying, it was a holy war. They went into the Russian for them reasons. It was a crusade to wipe them out.
It was indeed. I think we're going to have to do a part three in this series, Dennis. We haven't made our way right the way through it today, so we'll catch up with that next week. Thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.